You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, I just turned to Hunter Motz and I said, what are we going to talk about? And Hunter said, I think we should talk about echo chambers. And I think what he means is that we have various cultures in this country, and they tend to build walls and not bridges. And that is a terrible metaphor, but they all talk to each other, and they never really bother to figure out how to change or at least even look at the other side's point of view and try to figure out a way to not only empathize or at least understand where they're coming from. Instead of, which I see the progressive left does this a lot, but I'm sure the right has their own, you know, but my God, the progressive left, nice people, as long as you agree with them, what I think really bothers me about them is they're so fast to scream and call you a racist, mm-hmm. a xenophobe, mm-hmm. a sexist, mm-hmm. A rapist, all kinds of ists. And the minute you do that, and you know, you're talking about people who are complicated. I don't know anything about Steve Bannon. I don't right. know anything about Sessions. I know a little bit that I've read through the liberal New York media. who I don't have any respect for anymore. I mean, I'm really losing my respect for them. Talk about an echo chamber.
Right.
And talk about a group of people that are out of touch. So that's what I've read. But what happens is we brand Steve Bannon. I'm not defending him. I've never defended Trump. But we brand him a white nationalist. Mm-hmm. You keep hearing these themes. And you're mm-hmm. hearing it from the mainstream media. And so what happens is we take a guy who probably has a wide array of points of view, mm-hmm. probably some that have a lot of value and some that don't, but a whole varying system of beliefs and attitudes and ones that are probably always changing, as with most of us.
But also, crucially, if you do want to change some of his beliefs, you have to have a dialogue with him.
You have to have a dialogue. But what we do is we go, that guy is this. That guy, you talk about labeling people. Mm-hmm. And what the progressive left, I think, does more than anybody else, and maybe it's because they have access to the media. I'm sure the right would do the same thing. But from my experience, and maybe it's because I only read the liberal leftist media, they tend to, they'll brand you that and dismiss you. Mm-hmm. And you are actually not at the table anymore.
Right.
You're not at the cool kids table. You're not at the polite table. You're not at the quote unquote progressives table.
Right.
That word is very hostile.
Well,
I'm a progressive and you must be moving backward.
Well, I think the other thing to talk about is just the fact that, like, what has the track record of the progressive Clintonian worldview been? Like, have they actually lifted African Americans out of poverty?
I don't know the answer. I haven't looked at enough of the.
I think
a better question is, when we talk about a president that's going to bring us all together, which is the dumbest, most hilarious thing I've ever heard, this consensus building. Hillary Clinton is going to be way more unifying than Trump is. Well, if that were the case, Obama had 8 years. Obama,
right.
who I have respect for, and I think will go down as a good president. And I voted for him twice, and I'm not, I think that you have a guy. The United States votes in a black man. We're so racist in this country. We're so racist. 78% of the population at the time, or 72% was white and voted him in. Something like that. Anyway, he gets voted in.
Right.
And after 8 years, we are still divided. Well, we're still tribal. One man can't stop human beings from being tribal. One man can't stop human beings from not being included in the new economy.
Yeah, but so I think fundamentally this is what all this all comes down to is the fact that it comes down to culture. Right.
Yeah.
And actually, one man can unify warring clans. You know, I mean, the Muhammad did it. Genghis Khan did it. Abraham Lincoln did it to some extent.
Yeah.
George Washington did it. It's possible for someone to unify the clans. Right. But fundamentally, you need to come up with a vision that satisfies both of their desires and satisfies both of their needs and their wants and satisfies what they've been talking about.
Or an idea that trumps other ideas.
And so here's that idea. Here's that idea. All people are created equal, but not all cultures
in
terms of the biology, if you respond to
the biology,
all people are created equal, but not all cultures are equally suited to every environment. That's a refinement of the Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. and it's an update. It's the Declaration of Independence 2.0, and we could all rally around that idea. And what you would find is that a lot of the things that the right has been saying for a long time would actually be resolved by that. So there are a lot of thinking people on the right, like Thomas Sowell. And Thomas Sowell, you know, if you want to look at the evidence and the data and you want to read Black, Rednecks, White Liberals, he will tell you that this whole progressive liberal ideology is what has been holding black people from advancing culturally. Because essentially, after World War II, white people felt so guilty about the Holocaust and all those things that had happened. And guilt is an emotion. And guilt means that you only think about all the things you've done wrong. And, you know, that was an appropriate cultural correction to really sort of focus on all the failings of white culture. When you talk about what was done to the Native Americans and what was done, you know, to the African Americans and all that sort of stuff.
And to the Jews in Europe.
And to the Jews in Europe. But the point is that at a certain point, the guilt has to stop. And you have to be, okay, we screwed up in the past, but now it's time to make amends. Now it's time to make things right.
And I would caveat that with the guilt is not something you can probably stop. I think guilt is I have a lot of guilt. We all have guilt. But I think guilt needs to lead to action.
Yeah.
And the kind of action guilt should not lead to, though, is the knee-jerk reaction to pull down the quote-unquote oppressor. The idea that, well, let's just take white privilege or whatever it might be, whoever that oppressor is. Let's tear them down. That is to say that you would solve oppression mm-hmm. and solve power over people, this impulse for people to have power over people, by taking down the ones that happen to be in power right now.
Yeah, and also...
You need an idea to permeate into the minds of all people to realize that's actually not the strongest way to behave. That's
right.
Not the most effective culture to adapt. That science, that political philosophy, if you will ultimately render you bankrupt. There's a better way to do it.
Yeah, of course. And also fundamentally, it's, you know, it's not historically accurate, you know, and it's not realistic about human nature to heap all the ills of the world on white men. And the point is that I can handle that. If you want to like heap all the ills of the world on my shoulders, I will take it. I will take responsibility for them, and I will set about doing everything I can to fix it. And that's why we're here and we're having this podcast. But not everybody has the diversity of experience to be able to handle that. And so some of them, when you do that, they're just going to, you know, when you give people
they're
more...
They're going to buy another shotgun.
Then they're going to get angry. And, you know, and they're going to be like, okay, you're saying I'm the cause of all the world's problems? Well, fuck you. I think you're the cause of all the world's problems. And these are fairly natural emotional human reactions. And is it socially productive? No. But if you know, the reality is that the world is interconnected. And that's something that Westerners have a really hard time understanding. But every action has an equal but opposite reaction. Mm-hmm. And if you don't like the reaction, then you have to start to think about what was the action that kicked that off. Mm-hmm. And that's the place we're in.
I also think that if you look at when you call, you know, Trump supporters deplorables, I've been very careful not to call anybody who supports Trump anything.
Right.
Because I understand why people would have supported him over Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And she sucked as a candidate for a lot of reasons. But also, I think I understood where they said, well, I've been living under Obama's administration for 8 years. My life hasn't gotten better. I don't have the dignity to, you know, really put my kid in baseball and my daughter in drama classes after school or whatever it might be.
It's older than 8 years, though.
Of course
it is. This has been happening since the 1970s, and these people have gotten more and more frustrated because the system isn't working for them.
But then you have Hillary Clinton who comes along, and she's essentially speaking the same language Obama did and does. And you can't blame them for saying, I've heard this a lot before. I've seen how the Democratic platform works for me. I'm going to try this maverick.
But it's not just that. It's the fact that the liberal left has been refusing to have a conversation since World War II. They have been refusing to have the conversation about how culture drives success. And the fact that what you believe, what your worldview is, determines your choices and your outcomes in life. And that is a conversation that the right has been trying to have for a very long time. And that point of view is not one that was popular on college campuses, because fundamentally they wanted to drive a narrative that the only reason why African Americans weren't succeeding
is because they're being oppressed.
Because they're being oppressed by the white man, and because we haven't given them enough resources and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know,
very, very, very easy to do. You could borrow from both camps.
Exactly. And that is what mixed mental arts is about. And that is what
create a hybrid.
That's exactly right. And this is what the point of shattering the echo chambers is. You create a fundamentally purple worldview that is actually one that is grounded, like one of the best compliments that I've ever received on Twitter, and I think I've only ever received one, was somebody tweeted, you know, Callan and Motz aren't any, I don't have any sort of ideology. If anything, they're realists. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's the point of science. The point of science is that you go, you test all your ideas, and then you just work your hardest to try and get as close to how reality
works. Well, a realist is two people trying to solve a problem without adhering to any particular ideology.
Because I could literally, and that is the great thing about, you know, there are many problems with the Dutch culture. We eat too much cheese, you know, yeah. You know, we maybe are about some things a little bit too tolerant, right? Yeah. But there is this fantastic indifference to any sort of, you know, strategy or whatever.
Yeah.
That's the consequence of being constantly at risk of being flooded. You're like, whatever works.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh,
that's the Dutch experience. They're most of the country is below sea level. And so always the society has had to pull together and work together and, you know, deal with the fact that we have real engineering challenges in Holland. And there's always the risk that things are going to flood and you're all going to die. So and that's why the Dutch are so blunt, because it's like, hey, you're not doing your job. You need to go over there and fix that dike, you know, and all of that.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I am going to steal that the next time I do Rogan's. Yeah. That's
but it's this very pragmatic culture, you know, and the point is I think that's what we need, is we need pragmatism, because there's all, you know, the waters are getting high in a lot of sense, you know, not just climate change, but
the
also
the problem is that
you get
there are issues that are not a question of pragmatism. The problem
I don't know
is
that's true.
Well, let's take abortion.
Okay.
Abortion is a faith-based, for some people, it's simply a faith-based reality. There's life begins at the womb, in the womb, and there is no compromising, because what you're talking about is murder. And I as a pro-choice guy, I've always respected the pro-life platform, because that's their faith.
Right.
That's what they believe. And I can't scientifically explain to you why life doesn't start at conception. And I'm not going to try. What I say is I go, we put a price on human life every day.
Yeah.
And, I think a woman's, you know, desire to, or a woman's freedom to choose what to do with her body trumps that life. I believe that. And I'm willing to stand behind it. And you may call it unethical and immoral. It might be in your view. I don't hold that point of view. I think if you really were serious about saving lives, we'd actually bring the speed limit down to 20 miles an hour and no one would die.
Well, and that's the point.
And you'd make drinking and driving punishable by death.
But the point is that what you're recognizing is that there are some sort of compromises.
Yeah.
And it's not that there's a perfect solution for any of these things. There are trade-offs. But, you know, even though the science can't answer where should that line lie in a society, the science can answer how does morality and human thinking work. And that's John Haidt's work. So, you know, let's look at liberal thinking.
I've been trying to delineate the difference between Daniel Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, which I've been dropping lots of knowledge on Fighter and Kid with, and Jonathan Haidt.
But the key, Brian, is that it's not to delineate the differences, it's to reconcile them. Because ultimately...
Jesus, Hunter!
Jesus!
What the...
This is the challenge of, you know, the Western tendency is to split everything apart and try and figure out all the separate pieces. The Eastern tendency, holistic thinking, which is this complementary mindset, tries to reconcile everything together. Mm-hmm. And you have to remember, Kahneman is describing the human brain. You know, Damasio is describing the human brain. John Haidt is describing the human brain. So somehow they're all describing the same thing. And this is the blind man and the elephant. And we have to say, how is it that, you know, Kahneman holds on to this one thing and says it's
the tail.
Rope. Yeah, and all this sort of stuff. And then
and the other
know,
one's holding on to the trunk.
Yeah, and he says, oh, it's a snake. So how does all of this fit together? And that's, you know, that's...
We are here to tell you people... that it's about the elephant.
That's right.
Which really means we're hardcore Republicans. And that's the message. And it's been the secret message
that's
all
right.
along.
That's right.
Trump, 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 Trump. And that's the rest of the 45 minutes.
Drain the swamp.
drain the fucking swamp.
Yeah. So, but let's talk about how this all fits together, right? So it's very simple. It all comes down to Descartes' error. So thinking and feeling are always linked. So it's not that there's this idea, Descartes' error is that it's somehow, I know that when I'm angry, that affects my thinking. And I know that when I'm happy, that affects my thinking.
Yes.
But there is this myth.
And by the way, the way you hold your body affects your thinking. If you
That's
hold
right.
a pencil lengthwise in your mouth so you're smiling, you will think a Gary Larson cartoon is funnier than if you're holding it like this with the point out, and so you're in a frown.
Brian, those are amazing lip faces you're making at me. I wish and our listeners could see it.
You're welcome, audience.
But there's this myth that exists in the West, right, which is Descartes' error, which is that sometimes we're in this state that's free from emotion and that we're being purely rational, right? But in fact, let's talk about racism or sexism. It's that very often these feelings are unconscious and we're not aware of them, but that doesn't mean they're not driving our thinking, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what intuitionism is about, and that's why the great focus, if you want to be a mixed mental artist and you want to move forward, and this is what the green belt is about, is that you want to reflect. You want to do that slow thinking, because that slow thinking is the process by which you excavate all of the things that you've internalized from your culture. So you are like, wait a minute, how do I feel about black people? I hate them, and I think they're scary, right? And I can rationalize that belief endlessly. I can gravitate towards whatever pseudoscience I want or whatever it is. Or you say, how do I feel about God? I hate God. And I can come up with these endlessly complex rationalizations for it, but ultimately that's all they are. And the question is, what is the appropriate feeling about black people or God or women or any of these sorts of things?
Yeah.
And, you know, again, like there is science for that.
If you really study science, there's no such thing as black or white
people. That's right.
There's just people who either need, who have more melanin or less melanin depending on the latitude their
That's
ancestry
right. But
inhabited. Unless they were Inuits and they had access to lots of fish. Fucks.
But
I always ruin the intellectual discussion. My father's always like, don't say that word.
Well,
sorry.
Well, no, but I think we need you to say that word, Brian, because the point is all this stuff can feel so rarefied.
Yeah.
And we need, you know, stand-up comedians who are out there telling it as jokes. And like,
otherwise it gets boring.
It gets boring and stuffy, and who needs that?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the people want to be informed and the people want to be entertained. And, you know, a wise culture does both at the same time. But you know, that doesn't mean that even though our basic biology is the same, that doesn't mean that our cultures are the same, because our cultures teach us to overfavor certain mindsets that we all have. So Russians overfavor pessimism, right? And they constantly see the worst in the world, right? And that has consequences. It has consequences like the fact that 30.5% of deaths in Russia are attributable to alcohol.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
It's like a staggering number.
Jesus Christ.
And, you know, the professions that the profession that overfavors pessimism is lawyers. They also have massive alcohol problems, because a lawyer's job is to think about the worst case scenario and find all the problems. So the environment of being a lawyer or being a Russian drives you to overfavor pessimism. And the environment of being an American overfavors optimism.
Yes.
And so you're super positive, and it's
which
all
going to
work out.
Which might be why there's
out.
Such resistance to global warming.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And also to a lot of things. It's why we consistently, our foreign policy is, we're like, this is going to be great. We're going to go into this country. They're all going to welcome
us. They're going to think like us.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, reality check. Mm-hmm. Also, by the way, what is the profession that massively overfavors optimism? Acting. You know, you have to be delusionally optimistic to move out to LA and think that you're going to make it.
God.
But
do you ever?
But what's the consequence of
and
that?
And talented like me. If you think doing two TV shows and soon three is talent, keep going.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, but that's the point, Brian. You're realistic about yourself.
I
you
sure
see
am.
Yourself as the God that you are.
No, I was never realistic about myself until I failed for a good 15 years.
Well, and that's the point.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of people out here who come out here to act, and, you know, they're just sort of always waiting to get discovered, hoping they're going to get discovered. And they never sort of, and then, you know, age 70, they have that crushing realization that, oh, it's not
it
just going
to
happen.
It usually comes about 38, and then
38.
They end up opening a yoga studio or
there
something.
There you go.
Or becoming a life coach.
Or moving back to Michigan or whatever it may be.
Yeah,
but
it's tough.
But these cultures have, I mean, we talk about the word cultural bias floats around, but this is how they actually work. It's this over favoring of mindsets and, you know, a sort of certain beliefs that are not, you know, based in reality, like the belief that humans are purely rational sometimes. And that was a big one in the Harvard biochemistry department and at most of Harvard. There are a lot of people who they're rationalizing the whole time, but they think they're actually just being rational, and that somehow because they're not aware of the emotion that's driving their thinking.
It's gotten worse in some cases. I mean, we were talking about echo chambers, and the problem with echo chambers is that they, of course, will strip all the data that doesn't favor their conclusion.
Yep.
It goes back to confirmation bias. I mean, this gender war we have, it's not even a gender war, but these people who are jumping up and down and talking about gender, which none of us are really concerned with. I mean, some of us, I suppose, we're all for fair play, but the hardline feminists, the new ones, seem to be stripping biology away from the narrative. I thought we went through this already in the 70s, and science kind of put a stop to it.
Well,
but you have new...
But the point is
and
that,
probably not very scholarly.
But
does
it, the point is
in.
That this—that's sort of the whole point of this podcast. It doesn't matter if the science exists, if the ideas don't move, and if people aren't held accountable to it.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you can. You
sometimes
can,
science is too. It feels like sometimes science is so politically incorrect, you couldn't even bring it up.
Well, and that's why it often hasn't been, and that's why it's so problematic that the left has been able to dominate college campuses. Because science at its root is about a very simple principle, being responsive to reality.
And responsive to the evidence. And responsive to data.
That's right.
And responsive to experimentation.
That's right.
And for example, if there are aspects of Mexican culture, of certain pockets of Black culture that are... actually, rather than being unhelpful, they're actually detrimental to your progress in the 21st century, and certainly in the 21st century economy. If you were to bring that up, which really is another way of saying, hey guys, you got to change the way you think, and you got to change the way you live, and you got to change your belief structure. And you, at the end of the day, might be responsible for a large part, for the condition you're in.
Yep.
You say that, and you will get a shitload of people coming at you going, how dare you? They're victims. It's not their fault. It's your fault. It's your thing.
Exactly.
You can say that because you're from a position of white privilege. And so then they take all my ideas out of the picture. I'm no longer valid. In fact, I'm a racist.
Yes, that's
right.
In
fact, I'm a racist. I don't even know it. In fact, I'm a xenophobe. In fact, I'm a sexist. In fact, I'm a white privileged guy, and I should shut the fuck up because you know, I haven't experienced what they have.
But Brian, what we have experienced is we've experienced talking to 200 of the smartest minds in the world, and we can see how they piece together, and we find out very interesting things. Yeah. Which is, for example,
it's funny because I was looking at what I look like on the Skype. on the camera, and I was lamenting, so I missed a lot of what they said.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I find myself often wishing I had a little bit more brown in me. Something.
Yeah.
I would take Latin. I would definitely take Samoan, like a smidge. I want a quarter Samoan or a quarter Black. Yeah. And it better fucking be West African Black. I want Biafra Coast Black.
Yeah.
I don't want Kenyan Highland Black. I don't give a shit about running forever. I want explosive power. I want that fast twitch,
yeah,
baby.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Exactly.
Keep going, buddy.
Yeah. No, but I mean,
we've had the benefit of talking to 200.
And you find out very interesting things. You find out these sort of very, narrative defying, echo chamber defying insights. Like, for example, that Arab culture is the same as Black redneck culture is the same thing as white redneck culture.
I can just see all the Arabic people listening to us with a footprint that goes on forever.
Yeah.
With a footprint that goes back to Babylon.
Yeah.
With all that the Arab cultures have contributed, looking at you, like saying, I'm not listening to this goddamn podcast. How dare you, Hunter?
How dare you? And that's fine. And you have the right to do that. But if you're interested in actually improving the circumstances of your people, then what you'll hear is that ultimately the narrative is humanizing. We're saying all humans have equal worth and potential, but that we are all trapped in this history. We've picked up these ancient and powerful cultures that precisely do go back to Babylon. And now we're in a different environment.
I can see the Arab historians going, what about the Mongols and the British
and
the Ottoman Empire?
And the Mongols have the same culture. Yeah. So it's these herder cultures, and
that's actually true,
and that's what Nisbet is talking about, which is that there is this environment of herding, and herders have these bad property rights, and you know, I can come and steal your sheep, and I can mix your sheep in with mine, and so you know, and ultimately these cultures evolve things like branding, but the first defense of your property is very simple: you establish a reputation as the kind of guy you don't fuck with.
Yeah,
you're a crazy homicidal motherfucker who will gut you like a pig. And your kith and your kin down to the end of the line.
Yeah, and I have a lot of that in me.
Yeah, and well, it is that it's
because where I don't come from.
Brian, I mean, you know, to be fair to you, even though you don't come from there, those emotional habits have been passed on from generation to generation.
Well, I'm Sicilian and I'm Irish.
That's right.
I grew up with a father who would fight.
Yeah,
and my grandfather was Sicilian.
Yeah,
I grew up with. that idea, yeah, there the violence was a resort.
That's
violence
right.
was something that was spoken about.
That's
when,
right.
When you get to a point, my grandfather in New York, when the crime was so bad and they had stabbed this poor kid in front of his parents, and my grandfather said, "String them up! String these fucking assholes up!" He didn't say that. He just said, "String them up!"
Yeah.
What are we doing here?
Yeah.
You know, it's Sicilian justice. I get it.
But so
you know what, as you speak, I have to say that as somebody who's probably read, I think, most of Malcolm Gladwell's book, I am now realizing that Malcolm Gladwell is a huge, he steals a lot and puts it all. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell, all due respect, I love him, and he's done a great service. But by bringing to the fore all these thinkers in a cool and neat package, but he hasn't done any of this work himself.
But that's the point, Brian. That's the nature of how actual progress works. Mm-hmm. It's not that anybody comes up with this stuff. It's is that we package it together, we put it together in a form that people can hear, and we move these ideas out into the public. It is a bunch of hobbits standing on the shoulders of each other.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is Gladwell has moved a lot of these ideas. But by the way,
I love it. God bless. But, yeah.
But part of the thing too is that even when Gladwell does his job as a science writer, often the scientific community sabotages and undermines him without even realizing it. So for example, he moved the 10,000 hours.
Yep.
And then, you know, Anders Ericsson, who is the guy who did all of that research, and he lives in the world of science, which is all these super atomistic thinkers who are super concerned about their reputation, comes in and starts writing articles about how Malcolm Gladwell is wrong, right? And had misunderstood his research. And then you read through it and it's this very nuanced point.
Yes.
Right?
It is.
And
nuanced.
But that's not necessarily...
I mean, I remember that. There's variations on that.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's closer to 15,000
yeah.
or 20,000, depending on how you practice. And I, come on, all
but
right.
But the point is the diffusion of innovations, right? The book that never diffused, right? It says...
I need to read this book.
Well, you kind of don't. It's. I mean, you can if you want, but it is 567 pages and all it tells you is this very simple idea, which is that, you know, A, you're supposed to go off, read the evidence, understand it, and then once you've digested it, then you figure out how to tell the story in the simplest and most engaging way, in a way that fits each culture.
Well, Kahneman always talks about that too in his book, in that what the way you phrase something, mm-hmm. if it rhymes,
mm-hmm.
This is where a lot of black artists are,
yep.
and black language is
totally.
Really, really good. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
That's right.
You know, there were a lot of different, like, it comes from sort of probably from the musical traditions.
Comes from the honor culture. So what part of this obsession with honor that these honor cultures have is that they tend to be very bombastic. They talk themselves up. They have this very demonstrative style. Mm. So if you look at a Southern preacher and you look at a black preacher, right,
yeah.
and you look at an Arab imam.
This is not a democracy. This is a theocracy.
Exactly. And, you know, and if you look at an Arab imam, you know, they're very much the same thing. I mean, these imams give these very dramatic, rousing fiery speeches. And it is that honor culture. They're still being
so
driven
true.
By
it's
those
old... It's
very
true because Catholic priests tend to murmur.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It couldn't be more boring when you go to a... When you go,
a Protestant preacher? Oh, the most boring.
I know. My buddy's mom died and I went to her to the funeral in Harlem and I was basically the only white guy there. And man, was that a fucking celebration. Alma May wasn't a sad person. I don't want this to be some kind of a sad blow.
Yeah.
We're going to celebrate her life. And he started to sing. And he was a deacon.
Exactly.
I was like, this motherfucker can sing. And they were all like, hey. And they were singing.
Yeah.
I was like, what? I looked at Daryl, my buddy. I go, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
He goes, you never been in a church like this? I go, hell no, but I'm religious now. I'm religious now. Hallelujah.
But and that's the opportunity. The opportunity is idea
Sorry
sex.
To shout.
No, but the opportunity is idea sex, where we're like, hey, you know what? Like, those churches, those sorts of experiences are way more fun. And the rhyme and all of those, that sort of stuff is way more fun. But, you know, again, like I'll say this again, you know, JFK always said that D.C. was a city of southern efficiency and northern charm. And the Jeez. Opportunity is to make D.C. a city of
southern efficiency
and northern charm.
It's where innovation goes to die.
Yeah.
Where people still wear those terrible suits.
Where innovation goes to die and where everybody is fundamentally rude, discourteous, and has no ability to sort of win other people over to their cause. It's the worst of the two cultures. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity is...
But that's kind of... Is that true? I guess I feel... They always talk about how Washington, D.C. is more polarized than it ever has been.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's true.
Well, I mean...
I wonder if it's always been
No, it hasn't actually. So
civility played a, you know, I guess, yeah.
Well, no, so I mean, part of it, a large part of it is just the rhythms of war. So yeah. In, when, you know, the yeah. great, the, why is the greatest generation? Because in the face of a series of threats, the Great Depression and World
threat,
War II, yeah. an existential threat, what do humans do? They pull together.
Yeah.
And they sort of rally together and there becomes
and
a consensus.
And they become fairly homogenous too.
That's right.
You fall in line because you there's no time to be an individual right
That's
now.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you have that, but then peacetime sets in and you get this shift towards the me generation, right? So the baby boomers don't have this existential threat. And so the further you get away from that, the more it's about me and what I want and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And I think that the time has come for another greatest generation.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen without some kind of a cataclysmic effect. You know, Rogan was had these two scientists on, fascinating discussion on his podcast about the threat of meteor.
Mm-hmm.
And how in Russia, I think it was 2006 or whatever it was, when a meteor hit in Siberia and damaged about 1,000 buildings and injured 1,500 people. And that was a very tiny rock.
Right.
And it's interesting because he said there is a great deal of evidence to suggest that it isn't going to happen in 12,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it may happen sooner than you think.
Yep.
Right. And that was just interesting to me. And the I don't know what's going to happen with global warming. We don't know. But there are events that could be fairly cataclysmic that will require us to pull together. I don't know that you can do it necessarily with ideas, unless I start walking on water and you start turning.
Jesus, Brian.
You start turning water to wine. I said it.
Well, you can't.
David Blaine, where are you?
You can turn water to wine. You water the grapes and then you harvest.
Oh, you
it.
Son of a bitch.
Oh, damn.
You metaphorical son
what?
Of a bitch.
But I mean, that's the challenge. The challenge is, can we learn from history and can we, you know, because the meteor is coming. If you want to talk about the meteor
is coming,
and
one way or another, the meteor is coming.
No, I'll tell you what I think the biggest way in which the meteor is coming, which is that the disappearance of routine work. All these jobs did not go to China in the long run, right?
No.
They may have gone to China in the short run.
That's right. And China's losing jobs to Vietnam.
Yeah, exactly.
And Malaysia. And they're losing jobs to, you know.
And they're ultimately all going to lose jobs to robots.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you bring those jobs back, most of them will be done by robots. And when you know, all these things like the Arab Spring and what's happening with Trump, these are all just tremors. They're prequakes. The big, big earthquake is what happens when, you know, there are so many robots doing these jobs and these people have cultures that don't allow them to succeed in that environment, right? Because your biggest problem is always 15 to 35 year old men. Mm-hmm. This is the group that either they're going to be your greatest asset and they're going to really sort of drive the energy of the economy and they're going to drive your society and energies are going to be channeled into war or innovation or creativity or whatever it may be, or they're going to tear your society down.
Yeah, it's true.
And so the challenge, that's the meteor. And the meteor is coming and the clock is ticking. Innovation is happening, you know, better and better robots, better software is being developed. And ultimately, you know, that's sort of the issue with Silicon Valley is that, you know, they're sitting there in their little Silicon Valley bubble and they're like, this is so weird. Why are all these people angry? And it's like, you created machines that do humans' jobs. And when those machines exist, there are fewer jobs for humans.
Yeah.
And that is an externality. That's your toxic waste, Silicon Valley. Like, you've polluted. And there is your pollution. And so now you have to clean up and you have
to
deal with that pollution.
Well, it's just a question of how we adapt to that. That's the inexorable rise of,
that's right.
of technology. And you're never going to stop that. That's the genie that will always
That's escape. Exactly right. Yeah. And so the point...
And we have to adapt.
And we have to fundamentally all change our cultures.
Yeah.
You have to restructure your economy based on the idea that routine work is no longer valuable. So your educational system should not be teaching skills, which are routine work, which are the kinds of things that robots do best, right? And you fundamentally have to be creating self-awareness so that people understand that tools like optimism and pessimism are tools. And you have to know when to apply each one.
Mm.
We need a society that is wise so that instead of being sort of blindly driven by these old cultural intuitions of herding or, you know, American optimism or Russian pessimism or Western atomism or Eastern holism, that we are able to intelligently and wisely use all of these tools to solve problems.
You just encapsulated beautifully.
Well, that's my job. And my job is to communicate it to as many people as possible, and then as many people as possible go out and tell it in different ways.
And so the way that people can put that into practice is to, you know, not everybody has time to read Jonathan Haidt, Daniel Kahneman, and stuff like that.
And that's why we're doing...
But the way to put it into practice maybe is to be aware of first how your mind works, which is that you have a slow thinking mind and a fast thinking mind. The fast thinking mind is that mind that jumps to conclusions, that takes in a whole bunch of data and slices and chunks it very quickly at the blink of an eye and jumps to a conclusion. And usually that conclusion is going to be, and always that conclusion is going to be shaped and informed by your belief system, your parents, your
culture.
and if you don't know better, you will assume that conclusion to be true because it feels true. And what you really want to do is to stop for a second and say, my elephant's on the run right now. Let me figure out a way to dart that fucker. I gotta dart him. It's gonna take a little while for that tranquilizing serum to get to course through its giant body. But let me get him. Let me dart him up. Let me take some breaths. I gotta run and take some breaths. Let me not do anything for a second.
Yeah.
And once I dart him, I can get up back up on top with my mahout hook.
Mm-hmm.
And when he comes to, I gotta break his spirit a little bit. Let me turn this bad boy back into his cage. And you guys can feed him from the cage. Hands and feet to yourself, please. Do not let him loop your ankle because he's sneaky. Are you getting what I'm putting down? Are you getting the elephant metaphor? Have I figured out life or what?
Well, so that's...
So the bottom line is let's go into all the primitive cultures and uproot them.
Yeah. But unfortunately, that's the point, is that there's no culture that you're going to find on the planet that is the culture that we need.
No, right? Because there's a great deal about, thank God, for example, for black ghetto culture that came out of the South Bronx that gave us rap, that gave us our musical expression that we export to the entire world, that is mimicked by everybody from in Russia, China, bebop culture, you know, so there are, again, there's a lot to love about all cultures, and there's some things about cultures that are not helpful.
Like, for example,
to their
people and to their most cherished goals.
Yeah.
So, for example, like the libtard tendency to deny the role of culture or values in human success. So, you know, they go around and they're trying to solve this problem of, you know, how do we make America, you know, a society where everyone can succeed? But they only want to do it with legislation and spending. At no point do they want to challenge people emotionally and say, hey, you have this culture. And this culture is something you picked up from your parents, and it made sense in one environment, and now we're in a different environment. And it is going to drive your elephant to do things that don't serve your success. For example, if you were a herder, there wasn't much value in reading books because your eyes were off your sheep. And then your sheep might be stolen and might die. And also, as a guy from Alabama who I had a conversation with this put it, which I think is totally right on, reading a book doesn't help your sheep fuck faster.
That's funny.
So the point is, so in that environment, that belief and that attitude made sense. And now in the environment of a knowledge economy, you know, you have to value information. You have to love information. You have to be constantly trying to acquire it and letting those ideas have sex in your brain so that you can innovate.
I'm always amazed at how we cherry pick and how blind we are, and willingly blind. For example, I was thinking about this the other day. I was at a party. You know, I'm on the road doing stand-up, and I noticed that a bunch of people my age were literally, I was in this house, they were all doing blow. No. I mean, they were all so fucking coked up, I couldn't believe it. These are professionals, doctors, lawyers, and they wanted me to come because they'd been in my show, and they were like, and so I was kind of there, and a little bit of the guest that, you know, people wanted to talk, you know, just because I was, you know.
But isn't that a lot of your life, Brian, that
sure
experience?
Is, sure is. Yeah. But at this point, I will say I'm getting a little more famous with the Goldbergs, you know, and all that. And so, but then they were fans, and they'd seen, and I did well in the room, so they, you know, because I'm very funny, I don't know if you know that. And so they were all kind of, you know, I was getting a lot of attention. And what I noticed is everybody was so high. Now, one of my favorite pastimes is to have my day ruined I like to ruin my day with stories about what the cartels do to families in Central America and in Mexico, and what they do to the fabric of society, and how they make children be mules, and how they kill your family if you don't, and all that stuff. And I like to ruin my day and certainly not get any work done, because what I do is I go through these fantasies of how I would fight a cartel alone. And
go
I,
into one of those right
oh,
now.
Oh, no, no. I would be a very humble, probably a humble cart pusher. Uh-huh. And I would sell little trinkets. But under my robes would be a fucking arsenal of silent weaponry. I know how to silence a gun. I'd have all kinds of things. And I would just slowly wreak havoc. I would slowly, by accident, on purpose, kill their leaders and leave notes blaming other groups. I would sow dissension. Yeah, very useful. Very, very useful stuff that I go through. The point is that as I was watching these people who are seemingly good people, and they had money and they paid their taxes, and I thought to myself, most of them would be pretty vocal if Nike was using a sweatshop to make their sneakers, or most of them would maybe probably shop organically and not buy tuna fish that had been caught in giant dragnets that also caught turtles and sharks. Instead, longline fishing is better. But to get that drug from plant to powder and into your nose requires a great deal of murder and kidnapping and intimidation and destruction of communities and families. Mm-hmm. And I mean a great deal. Mm-hmm. I would bet that for every eight ball, it probably requires at least the death of 6 to 10 innocent Mexicans.
Yep.
And we never talk about that. And until you have the stomach to make all drugs legal, which I favor, but if you're not going to do that, then at least we can start saying to people who are supposedly conscientious, they certainly have money to spend on cocaine, if you really give a shit about human life and people, think long and hard about where that cocaine is sourced.
Yeah.
Is it local? And is your marijuana local?
Is it macrobiotic?
If it's not,
and
I'm being serious, if it's not, chances are that's blood powder.
Yeah.
That's blood weed.
That's blood
that's
coke.
That's torture weed.
Yep.
That's destruction weed.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot of children's tears
for
real went into that powder that's gone up your nose. We don't talk about that enough.
Well, in the liberal echo chamber, you don't. I mean, I think that's the, you know, why have conservatives been talking about liberal hypocrisy? Because the point is that they're so empathetic about some things, right? And they talk about blood oil and they talk about blood diamonds.
Yeah.
But at the same time, some of these people are doing coke and doing other drugs. And they're not thinking about what is the human toll of those actions. Where is it sourced?
Where's your weed sourced?
That's right. And
marijuana is how a lot of cartels make most of their money. I think it's great that we've legalized it in California.
That's right. But also, I mean, and that's the thing, you know, there we don't live in an age anymore where, you know, any action is consequence free.
Yeah.
Right?
I literally thought about it. I was like, I can never do blow again. I've never been a blow guy anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't like cocaine, but I just thought, you know, if you came to me and said, this is the purest blow in the world, poor me. Hey guys, I'm 50 and I can't do cocaine and risk stopping my heart. You know, I've been, you know what a blowhead I've been my whole life.
But the point is that, this is, it comes down to there are degrees of empathy. And for example, what's been interesting, I think, is sort of watching the liberal blue part of America react to the realization that a lot of people in middle America are hurting and have been hurting for a very, very long time. And what ends up happening is that's all filtered through old narratives. So you have, that's the irony, you have this black honor culture and you have this white honor culture. And when the black honor culture, liberals will make all the excuses in the world for that black honor culture, right? They'll say, yes, you know, they're worried about disrespect and all this sort of stuff and they shoot each other and, you know, whatever. But, we can't talk about how much they value or don't value education. It's our fault because slavery, and so we have to pay money and do all that sort of stuff. But then you have this white honor culture, which also grows up in extreme poverty, right, also doesn't have a lot of educational opportunities and has a lot of the and has the same educational barriers. That's what J.D. Vance talks about in Hillbilly Elegy. He says, you know, when I grew up, people thought that book learning and education was sissy and girly. And if you have that attitude, well, that's going to drive your choices. And over the course of 20, 30 years, that's going to have real consequences for your economic opportunities in a knowledge economy. But there is no empathy for those people from liberal America because they're racist. Yeah. And so what ends up happening, but this is the trap of the human mind, is that, you know, it's very possible for us to have two things that actually, when you look past the superficial, are exactly the same. Right, the honor cultures underneath are literally the same, and they come out of that same historical experience.
It goes back to what I always say: it's not what you think; it's how you think.
Yep.
And what's fascinating to me is the similarities in methodology, the way people's brains work, and they can be on the opposing side yep. of an issue, and they both think exactly the same way. The reason they're coming to a different conclusion is one grew up with guns because their dad hunted, mm-hmm. and their culture said you got to have a gun and stand and be able to protect your family, and the other grew up in a city where guns weren't right. around and only had a theoretical knowledge of guns. And but they both think in many ways the same way.
Exactly.
They're both about law and order.
Yeah.
More laws against guns. They'll talk to you about law and order, but they want to have a say in that law and order. They're afraid of that.
Well, goes back but the point is that this is a good time to look more closely at our elephant, right? Mm-hmm. So this is what John Hyde is talking about with our moral foundations or moral intuitions. So here's a question for you, Brian. Mm. Are liberals pro-life or pro-choice?
Well, that's a great question. Because I would say they're both.
Yeah, they are. In fact, on the issue...
Just like I am.
Right. So on the issue of abortion, they are...
Pro-choice.
On the issue of guns, they are...
Pro-life.
Okay. Are conservatives pro-life or pro-choice?
Pro-life.
On the issue of abortion. That's but right. on the issue of guns...
They're pro-choice.
Aha! Now, the point is that you can look at that and you can conclude humans are hypocrites. But I don't actually think that's a very fair conclusion. I think the issue is that, and this is what you understand as you look across all this work, is that everybody has these intuitions, and that's what Hyde's talking about life and life being value, and about choice and freedom being valuable. But we hook them up to different causes and different issues. And in reality, if you want to look at an issue like an abortion, right, you can't resolve that issue as long as one person has the moral righteousness of saying this is about choice and freedom and all of these sorts of things, and the other person is saying this is about life and, you know, the protection and the sanctity of life and protecting the weak and all of that sort of stuff. What you have to realize is you have to realize, okay, I have these strong feelings. Now we have to sit aside and we have to sort through the issues and we have to figure out where are we going to compromise. And there is a compromise because there is...
Well, or you frame the debate differently as our boy... Who is our boy who talked about how to frame...
Oh, Rob Willer?
Yeah, Rob Willer. Rob Willer, you know, through his research, I think at Stanford, essentially you can frame something by using different words.
Totally.
Sanctity is a good yeah. word for conservatives.
But you, well, but...
Equality is a good word for liberals.
Either way, you ultimately have to deal with people's feelings.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, you have a... Each side has feelings about abortion, and each side has feelings about guns. But... As long as we continue to rationalize those feelings, and we can come up with endless justifications for why we feel the way we do, but we don't actually solve anything until we start to deal with our feelings and figure out where are our feelings appropriate. So, and that's the basic challenge. Like, you know, what is the appropriate stance to have on guns? What is the reasonable stance? What is the reasonable stance to have on abortion? Because there is some point between, you know, conception and birth when killing a baby gets weird and creepy. And I don't know where that point is.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of people would say where the baby starts taking on human form.
Well, and some people would...
That would be very strange for
and
me.
And my old boss, Jim Watson, said that you should be able to abort a baby until 2 years old.
Jesus. He did?
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Well, that's a guy who never had a child.
No, he has two children.
Then he's a mess.
No, well, Jim just likes to say controversial and provocative things.
Like black people aren't as smart as
white people and all that sort of stuff. Mm. But, you know, so for him, it's just mostly about poking people's buttons and, like, trying to provoke a reaction, right? So, but the point is that, you know, you can, that's a society has to figure out where do we draw these lines, Where do we make the compromises? What are the choices of drawing the line here? Are there circumstances under which, although we would normally draw the line here, maybe we push it a little bit further out? So, for example, okay, maybe we decide that you abortions are allowed until the first trimester, but what if it's, you know, a pregnancy where the mother's going to die, right, and the baby's going to die? Well, maybe then we have to make a trade-off, and we have to say, well, we're going to kill the baby to save the mother's life, because otherwise they both die. And these are hard, difficult moral questions, but these are the questions we should be trying to wrestle with, rather than just sitting around and rationalizing our feelings all day and pretending like somehow we're being, and that's the key thing, is that our society has moved from being a reasonable society, which is where it was in 1776, to being a rationalizing society, where everybody just rationalizes their feelings and we all sort of recruit the facts that support our argument, and then we throw those things at people, and then we're like, oh, these people, what is wrong with them? Why won't they respond to my facts? Right? But you're not having an honest, and you know, if the word is being thrown around, intellectually honest conversation, because you're not being honest about who you are and how you actually work, and that you have an elephant, and that it has been trained by your culture, and that if you really want to have productive dialogue, you have to acknowledge, I have cultural biases, I have these feelings, mm-hmm. I don't fully know where they came from, let's talk them out, let's try and understand them, and let's try and figure out what would a wise society look like.
What would a wise society look like? Well, Hunter Motz, you do a beautiful job of solving all the world's problems, my friend, and I am indebted to you because it's creeping into my stand-up comedy. And as I get more famous,
yeah,
I look forward to a couple of things. One is buying another Tesla. Two is getting an even bigger house so I can walk around in my robes and tower,
yeah,
financially over my neighbors.
Mm.
Because that's what's most important. And third is having enough money so that, and I'm going to get to the fourth in a second. Third is having enough money so that if I do choose to have other women in my life, my wife can be bought off.
Oh, that's good.
Where I can say, go shopping.
Yeah.
After she strikes me about the face and ears, which I enjoy.
Uh-huh.
Fourth, and finally. Fourth thing, because I had to go through my appetites.
Yeah.
The fourth thing is to figure out a way to use my tiny celebrity that seems to be at least nudging in the right direction for the three reasons I stated before, to get these ideas out there to people like me.
Mm-hmm.
Not you, but people like me who think the way I do.
And
I'm a civilian.
And that's the point. Each of these things have to be repackaged. The point is, I can't solve the world's problems, but I can explain them clearly enough to people like you and our listeners, and then they say, I'm going to take these ideas and I'm going to repackage them in the way that my culture can hear.
Yep.
And that's how ideas actually diffuse, is when you retailer those ideas to
either... Well, the other thing
either...
I've gotten from you and from talking to these academics, these 200 or so people, is that I'm no longer intimidated by what you would consider an academic, a professor, a PhD. It just means that they've been exposed to more ideas, and usually they're pretty myopic.
Yep.
So, and usually they're a victim to their own thinking and their own schooling, and that has its own limitations.
Yep.
And I'm always fascinated and surprised at how unwilling they are to step outside their borders.
Yep.
That have been imposed on them because God, is academia a nasty place.
Yeah. And it's that's their culture. We're all prisoners of our own culture, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, again, so to talk about height, there are those intuitions of authority, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, oh, I'm an authority on my little thing, but that person's an authority on this other thing. And so how dare I think that I could also be an authority on that? Right? And that's their territory and all that stuff.
To be fair, I do think that there tends to be so much reading that needs to go into understanding a point of view like, say, David Sloan Wilson has on evolutionary biology.
Mm.
You know, he's done all this study on this work on amoebas and things like that. But but you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, though, you can grasp the central idea of someone's life's work. You know, I mean, you can grasp... You know, when you look at Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, the first thing you say is, this guy's brilliant,
yeah.
And he is, And then you go, gee whiz. But then you read, and you know, he's citing, he's also taking a lot of work that was done by his colleagues
yep.
and people that came before him and during him
mm-hmm.
and putting it all together and saying, I'm looking at all this data, and the bottom line is here's what I've concluded. And he makes a very good argument for the fact that you may not be in control of how you think.
Yep.
And that's kind of what you need to know about it.
Well, there's the big difference between theory and practice.
But would you agree that his book and most books are just a bunch of examples supporting the central conclusion?
Which is a really simple central conclusion. And by the way, right, there are faster ways to realize the truth of these sort of conclusions about human nature. So the point is that we can talk about thinking fast and slow, and if you want, you can go off and read Kahneman's book, right? And there is value to that. But you can also just watch your own brain at work. You can watch that fast thinking, and you can watch that slow thinking, and you can watch that in yourself, and you can watch that in others. And this sort of brings up a very large and uncomfortable realization that I've been having in the last few years, which comes down to what is the nature of science? What is it that science has achieved in the last few hundred years?
Careful, Hunter.
This is real.
You rabble-rousing son of a bitch.
This is real heterodoxy. So you have to ask yourself, so if you read a book like John Haidt's, you know, The Happiness Hypothesis, Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom, all it does is it says, hey, Jesus said this thing about love thy neighbor as yourself, and now the science knows why that was a good idea. And it says, you know, Jesus said, you know, you can see the speck in your brother's eye, and it's hard to see the splinter in your own eye. And now we know that why that was a good idea. And Shakespeare said this, and Benjamin Franklin said this, and all these other people said these things. And the question is, this becomes really problematic, because there's often an idea that, like, before science, nothing had been figured out. And yet all science is doing is sort of confirming and reinforcing what humanity already knew.
So what you're saying is become a Christian, become a Muslim, become a Jew, become a Buddhist.
Everything. Become a mixed mental artist. And I talked to Dacher Keltner, he used the word Christian. He says a lot of us scientists have come to this sort of very Christian understanding of human nature.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that amazing?
But the hostility for any kind of organized religion from people like Lawrence Krauss,
exactly,
et cetera, are missing the point. Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, there is an arrogance to their conclusion.
And that's
the
point. But they've missed the fundamental point of science. So inevitably, what has happened is that, you know, there's the scientific principle, which is pure and inviolable and can do no wrong because it's a principle. And then there's the establishment that has been wrapped around it. And inevitably, there is a middle period of science where science becomes powerful and it becomes unchallenged. And so it starts to build myths about itself and it starts to internalize those myths. But the great thing about science is that it corrects its own mistakes. And so now there are people like Haidt and David Sloan Wilson who are correcting those myths. But in essence...
Steven Pinker
and all that sort of stuff, right? Who says, you know, in the grand scheme of history, religion hasn't been one thing or another. It's just ultimately a thing. And this is a very Shakespearean idea, right? There's nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And if you think that religion is bad, then you will see all its faults. And if you think that religion is good, you will see all of its virtues and none of its faults. But if you think that religion is just a thing, just like science is just a thing, just like Facebook is just a thing, then you can see
it. A knife can be used to cut your meat or stab you in the heart.
That's right. And you will see it for what it is, which is a tool. Nothing more, nothing less.
God damn it, that's so zen.
Yeah, but it is. But that zen is...
Let me get into the lotus position. Keep going.
But that zen is because, fundamentally, you have to understand what is the human problem. And the human problem is not that the brain has difficulty forming theories, right? The mind forms theories without even trying, right? That's why the internet is full of conspiracy theories. It's full of all of these ideas. The challenge for the mind is breaking theories. And in order to break theories, you need evidence, right? You need something that conflicts with it. And while, you know, before science, we didn't have the tools to look at the stars or to look at bacteria. So we couldn't really break our beliefs about the stars or about bacteria. But we all had one thing that we could observe: our own minds and other people's behavior. And so we observe that, and over time, through this magical process of cultural evolution, these cultures figured out pretty good insights about how human beings work. You know, Shakespeare was able to notice. Why is it that Shakespeare has this timeless quality? Why is it that, you know, the best wisdom in Christianity has this timeless quality? It's because they'd already solved the problem. They'd solved the problem of human thinking. Why is the Buddha timeless? Why is there this weird phenomenon going on in science where suddenly, you know, scientists are rebranding Buddhism and calling it a science of the mind? because it is timeless wisdom. They'd understood these key principles of human thinking. And, you know, there's a middle period of science, which is incredibly arrogant, and said the past knew nothing. Right? They threw out the baby with the bathwater. And there were some things the past didn't know. They didn't know really, they didn't understand how disease worked. But it turned out they did know pretty well how human beings work.
And they did know how disease worked. The Old Testament, remember we had...
John Durant.
John Durant. God, you're so good with names. And John Durant, who wrote the Paleo Manifesto, which I really loved. Yeah, the Old Testament was the God of science.
Yeah.
I mean, the Jews covered their wells during the plagues. The Jews washed their hands and
To be clear, they didn't consciously know it.
No, but...
But they had evolved a culture...
They knew not to eat certain seafoods and dairy without, you know, you don't eat osprey. You don't eat animals like... That will eat other animals because you get trichinosis and other things like that. I know what you're saying. The point is that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Of course not.
That our ancestors had something to say. See the secret of our success, Joseph Henrich. The fact is that cultures, the reason you mix ash with certain foods is because it makes them not poisonous.
Or it releases the vitamin B in corn, right?
Yes.
But the point is,
say vitamin. Don't ever say vitamin because we're an American.
Jesus, Brian.
It's all right, buddy. But I love the way you just broke that down.
But
that's an amazing... I can't believe you just did that in the past. We had 6 minutes, and you just said they looked at the stars and they looked at bacteria, but we didn't have the tools to see the stars really and
of course,
see the bacteria.
Because glass making...
But we could read human behavior.
That's
and,
right.
And take stock of our own minds.
And the point is that the technology had evolved yet because it was cultural evolution. Culture accumulates over time. The technology gets better and better. And so now these things that the ancients sort of understood, they had this sort of intuitive understanding of how do you release vitamin B from corn or how do you deal with disease and all that sort of stuff. We understand it more explicitly, right?
And we also know that black people in the Congo were not as advanced as Europeans, not because of the color of their skin or their biology. It was because they were not able to share ideas. See Jared Diamond's work.
Well, and it's also the environment of disease, right?
Yeah.
That takes a real toll on a human people, and you know, not having access to domesticable crops, and fundamentally, you know, a large part of it is sort of being connected up to that hive mind, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, the more human minds get connected together.
In China, they speak Mandarin because the Yellow River was able to ideas were able to have. Sex.
Yeah, exactly.
And
you know, but
and
then,
they were able to borrow culture.
That's really, right.
Ideas, beliefs, practices.
That's
how
right.
We do things.
But the challenge is that, you know, Chinese culture is very holistic, right? But that means that it's very difficult to stand out. Right,
yeah.
So it's very collectivist, and you know that's bad for innovation. But that's not saying anything about the Chinese person's potential. It's saying that each culture does certain things well and certain things poorly. Right, and so to see that, you know, because Katie and I have been writing this, trying to figure out how to package this in a book for a different audience. You're going to take it to your audience. We're going to take it to our audience.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But the you know, look at something like the automotive plant. Right, Henry Ford. Right, a Westerner comes up with it. And why is that? Why is it that a Westerner looks at the making of a car and says, let's all break it down into its component parts?
Because they're atomistic.
They're atomistic.
Yeah.
But what is the car company that has perfected the manufacturing plant?
Japan,
Toyota.
Yep.
And why is that?
Because they're holistic.
And they understand that the parts have to be harmonized together.
Everybody is a leaf on a big tree.
That's right.
And so at the end of the day, Toyota is a big tree, and that's what I want you guys to take away from this podcast. Hunter Motz, you're awesome.
But the important thing to realize is that, you know, it's the wisest culture is not the culture that is atomistic or a culture that is holistic, because actually innovation comes from passing between the two, and that ultimately the greatest person is the mixed mental artist who knows when to be atomistic and when to be holistic, like Steve Jobs, who, although he knew how to think different and stand out, also was obsessed with Japan. And so he was obsessed with Japanese culture and Zen and all that stuff. And so that's why instead of creating these stupid, clunky, ugly boxes, he harmonized the whole thing and he made it all fit together beautifully.
That's
and there's a feeling.
He was obsessed with the Japanese aesthetic.
Amazingly obsessed.
Wow.
So he's a bit Steve Jobs, mixed mental artist. Ben Franklin, mixed mental artist. Jesus Christ, mixed mental artist.
Outstanding. All right, man. I'm blown away.
Yeah.
What a great, happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
On Thanksgiving and in my bedroom, actually, where, yeah, where all the lovemaking goes on.
Really, Brian?
Yeah, and I know you can sense it.
Well, there's a certain musk in
there's
the
a musk,
air.
There's
I
a
can
male,
smell things.
There's a rut musk.
Yeah, exactly.
I call it a rut musk.
Jesus, Brian. I mean, you know, forget like changing the world. Just bottle this shit and everybody will be happy.
Well, rut musk mixed with turkey fat is a beautiful thing. God bless you all and happy Turkey Day.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.